seems like every time I read passages that are this Christmas story, there's some part of it that jumps out at me all over again. You know, I was recently reading Ephesians because I was going to sit down and talk with someone about it, and I was getting ready, and I ran across this passage in Ephesians that I had never really noticed before. Like, you know how, like, you read something, and then you read it again, and you read it again and again. Every time, there seems to be something that just kind of pops. Well, the Christmas story has always been that way for me, but the scripture readings for this morning, even beginning in the Old Testament reading, the book of Isaiah, the passage we read from this morning was from the very end of Isaiah. And so Isaiah was compiled over the course of a long time. He talks about things that are before the exile, in the exile, and then the passage we read this morning was right at the end of the exile, as the Jews had either just returned from Babylon or were just getting ready to return from Babylon. So you see these themes of the Jews celebrating Jerusalem's redemption. There's this idea that focuses on vindication. Israel had been destroyed. It had been, the walls had been broken, the gates were torn off their hinges. It was indefensible and just destroyed. And yet, they believed that God would be sending them back. And then the prophet Isaiah writes this, saying, she will be redeemed, she will be vindicated, the city will be rebuilt. And we read Galatians, you know, hundreds of years later, we read Paul's letter to the church in Galatia saying, you guys used to be slaves, and now you've been adopted as sons and daughters, and now you are going to become heirs of God. You're going to have an inheritance from the Creator of the universe. And so this is that gospel, the gospel that's told not just in the stories about Jesus, but the gospel that was told in the Old Testament exile to Babylon. It was told in the promise that at some point Eden would be restored from the very beginning and all the way up through the promise of the church today, where we work to see the redemption of all things when God turns and everything that has been broken and wrong will be made right and whole again. So this gospel is this bigger picture kind of thing. It's not just baby Jesus. If you've ever seen that scene from Talladega Nights, you know the sweet baby Jesus prayers, and it just irritates me. And some of the characters in the movie even about, you can't just pray to baby Jesus, you have to pray to the whole of who God is. And that's about as deep as you could possibly get into Talladega Nights and still remain faithful to Sunday morning, so I'm moving on. But at the close of 2017, it seems like everybody is writing top 10 lists. You see the top 10 biggest news stories. I actually saw one that was the top 10 biggest lies told by the White House press secretary. Everyone's compiling top 10 lists. Looking back on the previous year, trying to figure out what was good, what was bad, what worked, what didn't, how did the year actually go? And so it got me thinking about if I had to write one of those articles about how I would define 2017, I think I'd define it as a year of tribes. A year where we looked around and we tried to draw battle lines and compete with the people who were just different from us. We pointed at the other one, that guy over there or that girl over there, and made them the bad guy for whatever reason we could think of in the moment. And maybe there's a good reason to disagree with them. I'm not saying we have to always be, you know, just agree for the sake of agreeing. But I think that instead of working for truth and working for progress, we've just settled for vilifying people and making bad guys and making enemies instead of progress. And so my kind of thought as I was processing this idea that God works for the redemption of all, is that at the end of 2017, it becomes painfully obvious to me that God's tribe is bigger than ours is. And it's not a statement of salvation. I'm not preaching universal reconciliation to God. And it's not about theology being right or wrong. But it's a statement about God's love for all people. It's a statement about opposing our tendency to take our neighbor and make them our enemy. So there's this whole idea of staking out territory. You know, there are the things that are ours. We have this individual drive to improve ourselves, to make things better, to provide for ourselves and for our family. And so we kind of stake out territory. And it reminds me of what happened. My grandpa moved into Brooklyn a while back. He got about 3 or 4 acres of land. And so he was certain just hop on a mower and just would go mow paths places because, you know, that's what you do when you have land. You go check it out and you go build things. And so me and my cousins, there were four of us at the time, we had, each of us had our own path, right? And so there was Kevin's trail, there was Marlene's trail, there was Elise's trail, and there was my little brother Brian's trail. And that was okay for a while. And then we decided, no, we need more than that. It's not okay just to have a little bit of space and a little trail. We need forts. Right, we need to build buildings and structures and towers, and we got to make this awesome, right? So my grandpa was actually building his house. So there's all this like construction stuff lying around that was just left over, and he owned his own construction business, and so there's plywood everywhere, right? And so we go and we start building these little forts, and I still remember my grandpa. I asked him how to build a fence with these logs and twigs that I'd drug from all over his property. And he starts putting it all together. Like, you know those like leaning fences where you just kind of like stack them and stagger everything and then it kind of slowly takes shape and, you know, eventually it becomes a fence. When he starts building it, and I had no idea what he was doing, so I'd like try and help and I ended up breaking it and I had no idea how long it took, but it took way longer than it needed to. But by the time we were all done, we each had our own little trails. We each had our own little, you know, our towers or our little forts. And my brother, he was too young, so he basically got what they used to use as an outhouse. They built an outhouse out of plywood, and we called it the Half Moon Inn because they cut a little half moon in the door. So that's what he got. We just stuck it next to his trail and said, oh, good, Brian, now you've got a fort. But then I went back, and I hadn't walked those trails in probably 15 years, right? And so 3 or 4 years ago, I go back and I walk, and I could barely find the forts, right? Like everything had grown over, everything had fallen down. Everything had just totally turned back into forest. You know, like I actually tripped over one of the pieces of plywood before I realized I was standing in my cousin's fort. And I think that what that means to me is that when we tend to build tribes, when we tend to try and protect our own stuff, when we mark our territory, it takes a lot of effort to keep other people out. It takes a lot of upkeep. It takes a lot of maintenance to try and keep our stuff in good working order. And so we end up working through this whole thing where if you start claiming more and more territory and saying, well, no, that's mine too, and that's mine too, what you're really doing is you're adding to your to-do list. See, if I had just let it be a path, if I hadn't built a fort out of my grandpa's, every time he mowed the lawn, he'd just run through the path once every month or so, and I would have had this great path, and everything's fine. The path was still there. But the extra stuff I built, the fort, the things that I built to keep my cousins away from my stuff, that's what deteriorated, because it takes effort to defend the stuff we think is ours. And so this idea about tribes that seems to have just kind of taken over 2017, it's about territory and protection. You stop evaluating people as individuals and you start categorizing them into groups instead. There's us and there's them, and they are trained to take our stuff. And the fences just require constant mending. So the question that's come to mind is, we've built a lot of fences and barriers over the last year. Things you're not allowed to talk about over Thanksgiving anymore. Things that, well, I don't want to talk to them because they want to make it about this and I'm, well, not that. And, well, I need this thing and so I don't trust that person or that politician or whatever. But the question that really keeps coming back to me is it possible for me to love my neighbor as I love myself if I insist that my neighbor stay way over there? And I think the Christmas story, more than anything else, is this story of universal outreach by God. See, Joseph and Mary, they took Jesus to the temple to fulfill the law that required. And believe it or not, they were waiting for the time of purification for Joseph and Mary, not for Jesus at that point, right? The idea was that Jesus, as the firstborn, needed to be bought back. That's what they were doing. They were going to the temple to not only purify themselves as parents, but to buy back their firstborn, because this is reminiscent from the Exodus, right? So in the Exodus, you had the 10 plagues. And the 10th plague was the Israelites each had to take a lamb and slaughter it and take the blood and put it on the doorposts of their house. Because the 10th plague was what the angel would come through Egypt. And any home that did not have the blood on the doorframe, the angel would kill the firstborn of that house. And so this is a tradition. This is a something that the Israelites and the Jews had always done to remember that act of deliverance, to say, this firstborn, we need to offer a sacrifice to God to remember what he had done and to remember this buying back of what has been given to us. Because even our children are gifts from God. And so at the core of a lot of these practices in Judaism, you get this sense of being other and set apart. And even as I say it out loud, it sounds a little barbaric to have to buy back your child from God. But there were laws for non-Jews to follow if they wanted to live lives pleasing to God. There was a space in the temple for worshiping, even if you weren't Jewish. And your conversion rites, so that someone who wasn't born Jewish could become ethnically and religiously Jewish over time. And so even in the Old Testament, as strict and as strange as it seems, there's this constant invitation to people who are not part of the in crowd, not like us, not part of our tribe. And so in the Old Testament, we see the Jews, they're struggling to stay uniquely and differently God's, especially during the exile. Because they lived in someone else's culture. They struggled to retain their identity because Babylon wanted to make everyone the same and then send them home so there would be Babylonian-trained Jews to run the Jewish territory. And so the backdrop of most of the Old Testament is written from the perspective of the underdog. It's written from the perspective of the oppressed, because only for a few short kingships was Israel really secure. You're looking at maybe the time of Saul, David, and Solomon. And then during the time of the reign of Solomon's sons, everything falls apart, and it never quite fully recovers. And so the time of the prophets, all these readings from the Old Testament, they're written to people who are struggling to remain who they are. They're struggling to remain gods. They're struggling to establish an identity religiously and ethnically and culturally. And they're always being conquered. They're always being subjugated. They're always being oppressed. And so it's hard to read those passages and feel the kind of depth of feeling that I'm sure the Jews read into that passage when they were experiencing all those things. Because as American Christians, we're not conquered. We're not subjugated. We're not oppressed. Sometimes we have a fear of those things, and sometimes the fear of that drives us to do things we shouldn't. It clouds our judgment. 1 John 4, it says, there's no fear in love, and perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears punishment has not been perfected in love, because we love because he loved us first. It's interesting, there's no prerequisite on who we love, it's just we love as a general blanket statement, because he loved us first. And so what do we do with our position of security? I have zero fear of someone breaking into our church and telling us that we're not allowed to worship God this morning. It's not something that any of us had ever had to worry about. We're still living in our home country. We have no real fear of exile. There's no army at the gates. During the time of Isaiah, there was literally an army camped outside, laying siege to Jerusalem. And in that context, half of the book of Isaiah is written. But when we get into that kind of fear of who might be at the gates or what might happen later, we end up making these delineations. And yes, it's better. We end up drawing these boundaries and these delineations, and we end up making people into others. And so we read the story of the Good Samaritan in particular. And Jesus said, okay, look, if you want to love God and love your neighbor, then this is the story you need to listen to. There's this Good Samaritan, and the Samaritan is not just a Jew from the next town over. He's somebody who worships in a different way. It's somebody that you went out of your way to avoid because he did everything wrong when it came to worshiping God. And so when Jesus says, not only is the Good Samaritan the guy who did it right in this case, he's the hero of the story. He's the one you need to emulate. It's this unconditional love. where somebody who is ostracized by the Jews would love their neighbor the way they love themselves, take him to an inn and pay for his medical care. And I wonder, I did a lot of weddings in 2017. Some of you were here. And I always kind of wondered, like, what would have happened if a groom had gotten up there and they had said, "Do you, groom, take this woman bride to be your lawfully wedded wife, heaven to hold this day forward, et cetera, et cetera?" And the groom said, "I do, mostly, as long as fill in the blank here." You know, like, I don't think the groom would have survived what came next, right? Like, in that moment, I'm watching some of you who have recently been married, and the woman is already glaring at the guy, and so, guys, if you get in trouble for me just mentioning this from up here, I'm sorry. But it's this idea that conditional love is just no love at all. Because a lot of times we make conditions because we're afraid of what might happen. What if I say I'll love you forever and then you change? What if I say I want to love my neighbors, I love myself, and serve them, but it turns out they're taking advantage of me? What if I go to help my neighbor and I do that for a long time, and then sometime I need help and nobody is there to help me? And so a lot of times when we're not really paying attention and thinking intentionally about what we're doing, we allow fear to take priority over love and compassion. And that's how we get tribes. We get small groups of people who are willing to watch each other's backs, and we're distrustful of everyone on the outside. We get exclusion. We get abuse. And I really do believe the biggest danger of this is not necessarily that it makes everybody who's on the in crowd an awful person. But the real danger is that we stop seeing individuals outside of our little group. We start seeing categories instead. Instead of seeing people with names and seeing Mike or Jamal or Esther or Aisha, all we see is white or brown or man or woman or Muslim or Christian or agnostic or Republican or Democrat. It's hard to love your neighbor as yourself if you just see a walking stereotype. And it's hard to truly love someone who's like you if all you see is an ally and someone who can do something for you, not an individual. And so I don't know if this is not a revelation at all to anyone else. Maybe I just needed social, like remedial social skills classes when I was a kid. But in middle school, I distinctly remember this moment. And there's two, like, epiphany moments I had about becoming like an actual social person and talking. One of them was realizing that people actually talked to each other when they were done with their homework instead of just reading books all the time like I did. The other one was I was walking down the hall and I happened to see some kid that I barely knew who had been a jerk to me the day before getting picked up by his mom from school. Right? Totally normal. I'm sure it happened every day. No, it was nothing drastic. But all of a sudden, I had this, like, cascade of awareness where I went, oh, my word, there's, like, 2,000 kids around me right now. We had about 600, 700 kids per grade in my middle school. And every single one of them has a family. They have 18 hours of the day where they're not at school with me. They have homework they've got to do when they get home. They have an entire lifetime's worth of experiences and memories. And I have absolutely no clue about 99% of it. They went from being secondary characters in my story to realizing that they have every bit as much stuff going on in their lives as I do in mine. They're no more secondary characters in my story than I am secondary characters in theirs. And all of a sudden I went, oh my word, what have I done? How have I been treating people, even subconsciously, not realizing that these people have an entire life's history? And then we get this story that some of you actually recommended to me. It's called Father Brown. It's from BBC. It's fantastic. We were watching this show, and Father Brown is just really good at taking stupid risks, right? Like, there's this murderer on the loose, and the whole thing is every episode he solves a murder mystery, right? In every episode, there's somebody with a gun, it seems, and they're about ready to shoot somebody or shoot themselves or shoot someone else. And he goes in, he's like, I'm just going to go talk to him. And like, everyone's like, no, you can't do that. There's no way you can go in there alone. Just wait for the police. Wait for somebody who can actually do something about it. There's no way you go in there alone. And his response is almost always to turn to them and go, well, I'm never alone. And then, of course, he walks in and everything's, you know, usually fine, and he talks the person out of it. He never gets hurt. And it just kind of, like, of course, that's TV, but do we really believe that God would protect us if we reach out in compassion? Because there were realistic, totally reasonable fears for why he shouldn't walk into that room with that person with a gun who's threatening to shoot people. Completely rational reasons. But do we believe that maybe God has something bigger in mind than just, well, I hope they only hurt themselves. Or I hope they don't hurt anyone outside that room, because I'm outside that room, and I hope I'm okay. Do you think maybe God has something more perfect in mind than just containing the damage? See, I think what enabled Father Brown to have that kind of trust is he could set aside his fear and say, God, I believe that what you want in this situation is for even the person wielding the gun to be okay. And so, yes, he took rather stupid risks, and I'm not encouraging you necessarily to go do them unless God is asking you to. I'm not telling you what you must do in all circumstances, but just to put that thought in your head, that maybe God wants something even more perfect. And so this is my hope for 2018. I don't need the nation or the world to fix itself before I fix my attitude. 2017 was this year of people being afraid of stuff and divisive and angry, and it was awful. 2018, for me and for you, it can be this year of compassionately actually seeing and serving other people, one individual person at a time. Friends and family don't have to just be allies to help protect you and your way of life. They can be people that you love and pour into on a daily basis, whether that's your wife or your kids or your parents or your siblings. People who are different, they're more than just potential threats. People who disagree with you, we can do better than dismissing, ignoring, or insulting them. I want 2018, starting with me, to be this year where we can look people in the eye and talk and ask questions and try to see individual people one at a time the way God sees them. Because just like us, they have an entire lifetime of experiences that have led them to this moment. They are beloved children of God, carriers of his image. They're endowed by our Creator with infinite value and deserving of our compassion. So in 2018, my goal is that we really put rubber to the road and we really love our neighbor the way we love ourselves. So as a benediction this morning, I wanted to read the Good Samaritan from Luke chapter 10, and then we'll dismiss. So there was an expert in the law who wanted to justify himself, and so he asked Jesus, well, who is my neighbor? So Jesus replied, well, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell into the hands of robbers who stripped him and beat him up, and he went off, leaving him half dead. And now by chance, a priest was going down the road, but when he saw the injured man, he passed by on the other side. And so too a Levite, when he came up to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan who was traveling came up to where the injured man was, and when he saw him, he felt compassion for him. He went up to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them. And then he put him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him, and whatever else you spend, I'll repay you when I come back this way. So Jesus said, which of these 3 do you think became a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? And the expert in religious law said, well, the one who showed mercy to him. And so in the coming year, may we all go and do likewise. Go in peace.